this, we're calling it GDPR Radio. It's basically a data protection people podcast where we just like talking and yakking on about data protection issues. So we, for the last year, actually, have had a group of consultants every week getting on a webinar, sharing it with people. It's not our show, this. If you want to unmute or comment and join in, throw your own experiences in, then please do. But what we've got every other week is what we're calling it, I don't know why, but we're calling it GDPR Radio. And it's really just really talking about, you know, what kind of things have come into our support desk during the week, what things we've been working on, what's in the news, you know, perspectives on current affairs really in the world of data protection. And every other week we're drilling into a specific topic, and I can't remember what we're doing next week, but we've, you know, we're diving into records of activities and subject access requests and breach reporting and all sorts of other things. So I think today, Phil Bryan, that's myself, Ollie and Dilik, we're going to be hosting the session today. I think Dave Holmes is otherwise engaged, so I think the three of us are just going to have a yak about it. I've been on holiday all week, so I've not done much reading apart from this morning. So it's a good job you've done a lot of preparation, Ollie. Do you want to say hi if you're on, and Dilik, are you on?
Hi guys, happy Friday.
Happy Friday indeed. Yes,
and Red Nose Day as well. So
is it
extra joyful?
I didn't know it was Red Nose Day today.
I think it is. So better double check.
you sat there with a red nose on.
No, but nearly a red face though, Phil, if I got the date wrong.
Yeah, that would have been good. So Ollie, what have we got on then this week? What have we been working on in the support desk? Anything we should be talking about for people to consider?
Yeah, well, we've got plenty on. I mean, I've generally speaking put together for this session, and as you quite rightly said, if anyone wants to suggest anything to talk about, then please do. Any questions, any points of interest you've seen of late. But I've got a series of things that I think we can talk through. I've done my weekly rounds on the CNIL website and enforcement tracker, which regular attendees will be familiar with at this point. So there are a few interesting bits to talk about coming out of that. And then a couple of wider bits that I've been involved in my working week. So what should we start with, Phil? Should we take a look at the news, or?
Yeah, we can do that. Yeah, absolutely, no problem. Yeah,
no worries. Well, let's get stuck into that. So, as I said, my weekly roundup on the CNIL website. So I've seen two bits of interest out of this. The first of which is, if you cast your mind back to a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about
an app. I remember this. The data still,
Clubhouse.
Yeah.
Who were responsible for what was quite interesting to refer to as you say, a data spill. Now, it turns out that CNIL have launched an investigation into this. They've been very proactive. One thing that is quite interesting is that they found that Clubhouse don't have an establishment in the union. Therefore, there's no one-stop-shop mechanism, and the CNIL do actually have authority to go and investigate this. They're looking to see whether the GDPR will comply to all of this, and then subsequently whether they're compliant with it. Another interesting tidbit being that this has been brought to their attention by a public petition that someone's been circulating.
Okay.
And people are basically saying this is invasive of our privacy, etc. You should have a look at this, which I thought was quite an interesting approach. And it's something I think we've seen out of some regulators. They're really taking a look at what's in the media and in the public spheres to inform their sort of decision making. The other one being that they have recently handed down an opinion on the use of smart cameras on public transport. So in France, like a lot of places across Europe and across the world at the minute, if you're taking public transport, you have to wear a mask, a face covering for COVID purposes, obviously. And in France, they introduced these smart cameras to basically keep an eye on whether people are wearing masks on the metro, on other public transport. Now, obviously, that in theory could be quite privacy invasive. So the CNIL initially said, well, A, you've got to be careful what you're doing with this, and then B, also, you have to be careful that you have appropriate statutory backing for this, that the law actually says you can do this, which it didn't initially. Subsequently, there has been a ministerial decree which has legitimised it all. So there's the relevant statutory backing there, which allows them, amongst other things, to limit the right to object sufficiently, which I thought was interesting because that's one of the points they'd raised. And then subsequently off the back of this, the CNIL said, okay, that's fine, as long as you make sure that you're only using this for statistical purposes and for informing your sort of comm strategy, and that you're not specifically processing biometric data, facial recognition, or sort of going after repeat offenders off the back of this. So there's a lot of things going on in there. It's very proactive, quite transparent communication, actually, from the CNIL on all of this. So I thought that was all relatively interesting.
Go back to that Clubhouse. I'm not following it. How is it that they've determined that they have competency to intervene in this?
Yeah, so I have to say they were pretty light on this, but it is something that I picked up on when I was reading this morning, which is they've determined that Clubhouse don't have an establishment in the EA for the purpose of the GDPR. So therefore, Clubhouse, when they are communicating with regulators, can't benefit from the one-stop-shop mechanism. And off the back of that, seemingly the CNIL have decided that therefore any regulator in theory would have authority, would have competence to take on this investigation. And they just
so all regulators. Do you mean all regulators? So all 27 regulators?
In theory, that's what they seem to say, yeah.
Right.
But they've decided they're taking the lead. They're communicating with the other regulators. They're sort of taking a joint, almost task force approach to it, but the CNIL are heading it up, which I thought was really interesting in terms of how they sort of go about coming to that decision. I say I'd like to know a little bit more about the background to it, but I couldn't find anything to that effect.
Oh, right. Okay, interesting. There's a comment about, could we talk about Oliver Dowden's announcement about the UK departing from the GDPR kind of, which I think is interesting. I think we should definitely try and cover that off, because that was a really weird speech, I thought, that announcement that the government made.
Yeah, I didn't catch that, to be honest. Do you want to get into that now? I'm curious.
Well, it was a couple of weeks ago, and it's widely reported in the Law Society Gazette and Reuters and all sorts of places. The announcement was that the next information commissioner, the brief is going to be to try to loosen the regime. That's my take on it anyway. The fact that the UK has now got the freedom to strike its own partnerships and write its own law. He's saying that the appointment of the new information commissioner is going to be focused not on just privacy, but also on the use of data for economic and social goals, which actually sits with the data strategy, the UK national data strategy, doesn't it, where they've said, in that they're trying to, make sure that data is seen as a thing to generate value rather than a thing to stop processing of. The UK, I can't remember exactly how the UK national data strategy phrases it, but it kind of says, don't be afraid of collecting data and using it. We need to loosen the regime. And how much of that comes through, I don't know. But I also read something which I haven't managed to pin down today in Lexology, that there's been some pushback from European members of parliament about the UK's adequacy. So I've not actually tracked that down yet, but I was interested to try and find out more about that.
No, definitely. And I think, correct me if you feel otherwise, but that's generally the perception that we've probably had of this potential adequacy decision. Since we started talking about it some months ago, is that there would be pushback to a degree. And I think potentially this idea that we're going to be sort of not necessarily making our own rules as per se, but leading the way as we see fit almost within our own jurisdiction potentially is part of that and, fueling that clash potentially, I'd have thought.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, one of the best blogs I like is Amber Hawk, written by Amber Hawk, who are a superb law firm. Again, they've got a good blog on this speech that Oliver Dowden's made. So again, if people want to have a quick read of that, it's a speech, isn't it? Whether it's actually on message with the government more broadly, don't know. But it was certainly raised a few eyebrows, but he was saying that as they launched a competition for the new commissioner, I didn't realise it was a competition. Maybe it's some kind of spot the difference competition, or I don't know what sort of competition it is to find the new information commissioner's new information commissioner. But they're saying that whilst they're launching that, they're going to try and change the emphasis. Interesting stuff.
No, definitely. Well, speaking of goings on in Europe. I mentioned before, did my weekly roundup of Enforcement Tracker, and there are a few interesting cases coming out of that, which I thought would be worth raising, if that's of interest to the session. The AEPD have been particularly active, as they always seem to be, and a few cases coming out of there which I thought were interesting. One is that an organisation was fined recently €3,000 for sending a document relating to one client to the wrong recipient, which seems like
time, doesn't it?
Pretty benign incident. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the most common breaches, I'd say, that we deal with, particularly on support. So the fact they've been fined €3,000 for this, I thought was quite significant, actually. And there are a couple of other instances like these that I've picked out over the week, which is the one where a company was fined €2,000 for failing to provide a website privacy notice, and then their privacy notice, which they had internally, didn't cover all Article 13 requirements. I suppose to a degree you can understand that, because it's not exactly something that's very difficult to get right. In fact, it's one of the easier requirements to meet, yeah, I thought. Yeah. So £2,000 potentially is proportionate, I don't know. And then another one where a private individual was fined €1,500 for CCTV, which they were a controller of and didn't provide appropriate signage. So instances of much sort of smaller fines for arguably, I'd have said, smaller infringements potentially.
Well, the AEPD does seem to issue small, you know, lots of, but low value fines, don't they?
Yeah, no, definitely. And the only other one that I found from them, which I thought was interesting in terms of the way they went about it, was they fined an organisation about €12,000 for providing a loan to someone who was an identity thief, who had stolen someone else's details and used them to get a loan. And the APD found that as the data belonged originally, so to a data subject and not the person who was usurping their identity, they found that actually the company didn't have a lawful basis for processing that information, and therefore they were infringing on the GDPR.
Right.
Which I thought,
just clarify, Ollie, the AEPD is a Spanish regulator, and
sorry,
I can't pronounce the full title of the organization, but it's effectively the Spanish equivalent of the Information Commissioner's Office, isn't it?
Yeah, I won't attempt that either.
But they're very good. They do some really good work. Some of their guidance has been fabulous, particularly around privacy by design and by default. They've written a fantastic guide in English, and they got, you know, I think we've covered it before, haven't we? We've talked about privacy by design and by default, you know, the seven principles of privacy by design and by default, and kind of a life cycle. It's a really good piece of work, but they do some good work, the AEPD. Sounds like some American police department, doesn't it, actually?
well, the APD, drop the E from that, is the Belgian Data Protection Authority, which is just confuses the matter.
Confusing.
Yeah, I looked at one of their fines this week, which I thought was interesting. They
so what do you make about this not having a lawful basis? So, yeah. You know, so the fact that you haven't, you know, you've provided a loan to somebody, who's the wrong person, means that there's no lawful grounds for processing that person later. I'm not sure I get that, do you?
Yeah, I'm not sure. And to be honest, I'd like to get that judgment translated and dig into a little bit, because I'm not sure. But then again, how would you potentially find someone for a breach of the GDPR on
if the lawful basis was consent, I guess you could say, well, you haven't obtained consent of the data subject, you've obtained the consent of a third party. If the lawful grounds was the legitimate interest, I don't think, you know, I don't see how you could challenge that, because, you know, whatever you do as a legitimate interest assessment, you might say, well, there's a risk that we've got the wrong person, but it's probably a small risk, and presumably some kind of identity verification, you know, maybe it was just a real bag of bones in terms of the way they approached it. But
if someone manages to get that translated, I'd like to look at that as well. I'm baffled why they went with the company, not the individual, for kind of criminal charges against the individual.
Well, they might have done that as well.
Yeah, but doesn't that shake up things for companies like loan companies and things like that? Because when you do join up, you have to provide verification documents and all sorts. How is a company supposed to verify?
Well,
pandemic.
Yeah, in the UK, there's different provisions, aren't there, in the Data Protection Act around credit credit and insurance purposes. So in the UK, it might be that, you know, you need to be citing one of those lawful grounds rather than one of the six in the UK GDPR. But I mean, of course, you know, there's slight variations and differences in the some of the aspects of how the GDPR has been, or, you know, some aspects, whether it's been implemented in into each European country. So it could be that in Belgium, then there's a peculiarity, you know, we're talking about Belgium or Spain. There could be a peculiarity in that country, which isn't there in the UK, same as we've got, you know, our lawful bases at the back of the Data Protection Act for certain processing activities. It might be that in that country they've also got them, and maybe they failed to satisfy those legal grounds that we're not fully aware of. Yes, it could have gone beyond the GDPR. It might have gone into their own national data protection law.
And also, the data subject that was that had their identity stolen could actually come after the company, even though company really. I don't know. I personally don't see them at fault here. If they've done the due diligence, if they've done the checks, if they've verified the documentations and the information, because it's too easy to get a loan these days. So I don't know. That's a worrying one, actually.
Yeah. So, Ollie, whilst you're on, Dilik, what have you been up to this week?
I've been in the world of audits.
Oh, have you? What have you been doing?
Oh, I've just finished the audit for the charity client. So that's finished and it's in peer review stage. So that's
how was it? How did they do?
Oh, bless them. They need a lot of support. They need a lot of help. So Oliver, as their assigned DPO, I believe, you got a lot of work cut out for you.
Have I really?
Okay. Yes, I have to.
So what kind of things, Dilik, what kind of things need fleshing out there?
Well, I highlighted something like 100 recommendations. So not feel I feel for the person. I was speaking to the client and I kind of gave him the heads up to saying that, you know, just be mindful. There's going to be this. They process children's data. So that's a big, big concern. Processing a lot of children's data, the specific illness. So there are concerns around the collection and use and the storage and the security. They're also doing some other activities that are a little bit intrusive or invisible processing that needs to be
fundraising type stuff.
Yes. Or obtaining data from that fundraising channel without appropriate privacy and data protection checks.
Right.
Breaches rights. The seems like a number of people have very good understanding of the law and can apply it, whereas majority of the departments don't really. They understand the concept of the law. You know, it's supposed to protect personal data. However, when it comes to actually how does this apply to my department, and that is the one common thing I do find when I do audits. One common thing is how does this actually apply to fundraising? How does this apply to the collection of children's information? How does this apply to comms or housing services and all sorts? So that's usually where they fell short. But Don't envy you, Oliver. Good luck choosing with you.
So, what have you seen, Dilik? Anything you know that you want to talk about in the news? I saw, you know, the reports in the BBC. There's been a huge increase in scammer calls. In fact, what the article in the BBC was that the phone scammers said, "Give me £1,000 and we'll stop calling you." So that seems to be a new angle. But I said, I think on the week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, I hardly get any, but I got 7 that particular week. I think I got 2 on the home phone and 5 on my mobile, both of which on the TPS. And I had all sorts of things from your national insurance number has been stolen to your broadband has been used for nefarious activities. We can press 1 to contact a technician through to that you're subject to a serious criminal investigation. And you needed to press a number on the keypad to get through to the investigating officer. So, what this article is saying is that they're taking a, you know, much tougher line now, the scammers, you know, really, you know, with quite threatening stuff. So I ended up reporting them all to the ICO and, you know, wrote out this elaborately long statement. You know, you fill in the report and it says, you know, did this cause you anxiety? So I wrote out this particular, you know, 2 paragraphs so I could copy and paste rather than having to think it all up again. I've stored it in my Outlook notes so I can recycle it. But whether anything comes of it, you know, it's always nice to see someone get fined and you think, yeah, I remember reporting them, but it takes ages to get through the system, ages and ages. And often, I've told you before, haven't I? I went to a friend's wedding years ago, 5 years ago, and he sat me next to this bloke called Tony Abbott, who owned this company, I can't remember what they're called, a data broking company, who'd got fined by the ICO, like £150,000. And they decided to liquidate the company and set up doing the same thing with a different company. And he just laughed at me. He said, because Simon and my friend sat together thinking that, you know, we'd have something common to talk about. And I felt like punching the guy because he said, no, we don't bother about not bothering about the ICO. It's not much money anyway, the fine. But it's so easy to kind of, you just fold the company up and start again. Well, it was the chairman of Huddersfield, Halifax Town Football Club. And, you know, so if you Google him, you'll probably find out all about, you know, his antics. But a terrible, terrible, terrible operator. But why don't they ban them? You know, why don't the ICO ban them? And I said a couple of weeks ago, why don't the ICO, you know, people like that should know better and they should be prosecuting them personally under Section 199 of the Data Protection Act. You know, it says that they'll punish the directors of companies that are acting, in a conniving way. And he is. But they don't seem to do anything about directors. Just fine the companies, don't they?
So you're talking there about nuisance calls and texts rather than scams. Rather than
it's all the same, isn't it? It's all the same.
It's a bit of a sore area because me and my sister witnessed a car collision. This was, I think, about 2 years ago. Anyways, we had to do a police statement, and the police was the only person that me and my sister spoke to. So everybody in the area who witnessed the crash gave their statement, and all to the police officer gave our statement, gave our details, and that was it. And then about 3 weeks or 4 weeks later, me and my sister started to get hounded with calls. You've been in an accident and this, that and the other. And there was loads of companies calling me. At least three or four called me. And I know my sister got contacted as well. And we were on the TPS. So the phone line, you know, you should really be contacting individuals. So the police was the only one we gave our details to. So, you know, what does that say?
Well, it must have been on, I mean, I don't know if we're under insurance, but I mean, there's been lots of prosecutions or a handful of prosecutions of people, you know, and insurance car crash companies.
I think we're going down a dark route, Phil, if we're talking about these.
Yeah. So what have anything that you've noticed then, Dilik, that we should pick up on? I don't know. I'm not looking at the chat. I have to look at the chat, see if people want to talk about anything in particular. You crack on there, Dilik. I need to go at 1 o'clock as well, I'm afraid. I'm going to have to dive off a bit early.
No, I think there's obviously a very interesting breach I'd like to talk about. But I think, Oliver, you've got a couple that you want to add in there as well. But the thing that I come across is the regulatory sandbox report that the ICO did with, in collaboration with the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government.
Right.
It's a very short bit of guide. It's a report. It's only 13 pages. I'm not looking at the big one because it's just too many and, you know, we get lost amongst those. It was a kind of an agreement to get into the sandbox to pilot a process, a system, whereby it's called the Blackpool Housing Quality Pilot. And what it was is that it will enable the Ministry of Housing to work alongside the Blackpool Council and the Department of Work and Pensions. So collectively to collect all the information about rogue private landlords, collect information about them, because there's parts of Blackpool, there's about 80%, which of the report is on the ICO's website. There's about 80% of these tenants that are on benefits. Now, benefits are getting paid directly to these private landlords. Now, as it's a guaranteed income, they seem to be falling short on some of their obligations to maintain a safe home. They are, you know, the illegal now amount of occupants and things like that. So that's the purpose of that project, is to combine the data in that area and to discharge their the Blackpool Council. Anyways, so the good thing is,
stuck it in the regulatory sandbox.
Yeah, so they stuck it in there, and they were one of the ones that got approved. So that I like the sandbox, regulatory sandbox, because it's a good initiative. It's helping new design, new. Yeah. And the main thing that came out of that really was that there were some concerns. It sounded like they were going to collect a lot more information. So the ICO managed to engage and debate about the use of data. But the things to come out of it was that, you know, it's about, you know, the ICO's advice around that was data minimization, ensuring the importance of minimal data per the purpose. So the purpose was needed to be clearly defined. Also, there seems to be a lot of discussions around what was the lawful grounds in undertaking this. Sorry, guys, in undertaking this activity. So there was public interest as one. However, because the Black Ball Council has some regulatory duties that can take upon, maybe they can rely on that. So there seems to be still some further discussion needed. But right now, lawful grounds need to be defined. They also said that you need to limit the purpose, because the initial project is to gather this information, to know who's rogue landlord, and to action as appropriate. However, I think the one thing that struck with me was that if this was going to be successful in the Blackpool area, they were definitely going to think about rolling this out across the UK potentially. And that raises its own sort of concerns, because if you think about it, and I know that mass amount of data, it's very difficult to manage the authenticity, the accuracy. And, you know, the one thing that the ICO did highlight to the ministry and also the council and DW is to make sure that it remains a authentic data, you know, that you're getting it from trusted sources, etc. So that was very interesting. I think my concerns were the mass amount of data. Once they have this information, who then manages that information? Because these are controllers in their own rights, but then they become a joint controller to some aspect. So there's still some discussions around that. But yeah, complex sharing.
I think the regulatory sandbox is unique, isn't it? I think there's other regulators saying they're going to pick up the same idea, but I think it was a great initiative the ICO launched. It must be five years ago.
I wonder who they selected. So I know a client of mine registered. This was over a year and a half ago. They registered to partake in the sandbox. So I wonder who they've actually and how they decided, because on their report, they're saying that they select organisations based on the innovative design, based on the drive, or based on where it's heading to. So I just thought, I wonder who got selected, because I know about the council and the housing.
I don't know how. There's a process for getting stuff in the regulatory sandbox. Gary just made me laugh. He's put up a news story of a marketing director who's been banned from being a director, but he now lives in Australia, and Gary says that the enforcement notice didn't involve a deportation order, but maybe it did, and maybe he lives in Australia now because he got shipped over there. And anyway, yes, who knows. I'm gonna have to dive off in a short and leave you and Ollie to finish off, I'm afraid, if that's okay. Ollie, what else have you been up to? What are you up to next week? What else have you seen? That thing you sent through about, was it you? No, Dave did, didn't he, about employees' emails. This is Danish law, isn't it? This is the Danish Data Protection Agency. And it's been through the Danish courts, hasn't it? Danish courts have ruled that a subject access request for this particular employee, former employee, to access their emails was considered to be too extensive in the specific circumstances of this case, and therefore, you know, they didn't have to comply with it. It was an excessive request. Did you read that one, Ollie?
I had a glance at it. Yeah, I need to dig into it more.
Well, I think there's a lot more to this than meets the eye. So I've read some other stuff, and again, the peculiarity of the Danish law, you know, around employment and around, you know, aspects of the data protection. I think it's dangerous to read this and make broad assumptions without absolutely knowing the detail. Because I was reading something else about one of the other European Union members, and this was all about, you know, employee emails are ring fenced from SARS in this particular country, and should they be? And that made me think, you know, we can't assume that everyone's got the same kind of standards that we have. Therefore, we talk about these international cases, but, you know, there could well be nuances that, you know, unless you get the nuances, it was really dangerous to assume, all right, okay, well, we're going to adopt that over here. Anyway, that's my piece, Ed.
Kathy will agree with that.
Yeah. Right, I'm gonna dive off if that's okay. I'm gonna leave you to finish off. It's been good to take part in this. I'll leave you to kind of run on. We say that these are going to be about 45 minutes, don't we? These kind of shorter sessions. So, if that's okay, I'm gonna dive off and hopefully catch up with everybody next week.
No worries, Phil.
Yeah. All right. Catch you later.
Take care. In a bit.
Cheers, mate.
Bye. Yeah. So, I mean, unless anyone has got anything in particular they want to talk about, and you want to fire that into the chat right now, I had a point which I was going to offer up for discussion, because it's something which I've come across on a number of occasions this week. And Dilik, if you don't mind me picking your brains about it, seeing what you think, which is the concept of processors producing proactive due diligence. Now, I ask about this because obviously under Article 28, where you're a controller, you have to make sure that you're only employing processors providing sufficient guarantees over your technical organisational measures. Therefore, you have to do due diligence. Now, I work with quite a few clients who, by virtue of their products and services, are always going to be processors.
Yes.
And so we often find ourselves having to do quite a lot of due diligence, you know, answering all sorts of questions. Sometimes it's very high level. In fact, sometimes it's a little bit too high level from the controller's point of view, but sometimes it's actually really quite in depth. And one of the approaches that we've decided to take with a number of these clients, in fact, all of them going forwards, is going to be to try and produce some materials to proactively answer a lot of those questions. Almost like a, you know, an FAQ, just sort of hand that out. Look, this is everything that you need to know about our organization. This should allow you to conduct your due diligence and, you know, get that assurance that in fact we do know what we're doing with your data, we have got appropriate controls in place, etc. I wonder if you had any thoughts about that, you know, whether maybe that works, whether there are limitations to that, you know, if there's actually value in doing this beyond it just being potentially convenient for us.
Of course there is. I too have clients that are data processors, quite a few of them are. I don't know if you remember, Ollie, a few weeks back I provided you with documents highlighting that particular client's products, what data has been captured, the retention requirements and so on. I do encourage data processors to be proactive and create relevant documentations. Just naturally, they're going to be subject to a lot of controllers sending all sorts of questionnaires. Some are quite poorly created and really wouldn't get what they need to out of it, but they are controllers. But I agree, we do need to create materials that not only highlight the processing, because what you find, especially some of these more sophisticated tools, the average person might not understand exactly what is it capturing, or what's going on in the background, and how does retention and security apply, especially if it's a cloud-based tool. So you always want to produce materials, you know, and also data protection impact assessments. So I have one client that's subject to quite a lot of them, just because of their interaction with the NHS. And what we are going to be doing over the next few months is creating a master DPIA. And what we'll be doing is it's going to be a very in-depth assessment, everything and anything about the tool, so that what happens is when there's a request that comes in and my client is not inundated with tons of requests for DPIAs, because they get some of these DPIAs are up to 30, 40 pages. And therefore, it's very, very daunting. So it's a heavy burden on data processors. So anything that can be produced is great. I'm not sure whether you've come across websites, Oliver, especially data processors. I've been interviewing three data processors on behalf of a hotel client, and every information that I needed was on their website. So if I needed a copy of their ISO 27000 certification, pop onto their site. If I wanted to know how they report incidents, it was their live reporting from their performance of their site. If I wanted to know whether they had any sub-processors, they had that list. So by being proactive, you can almost address most of the controller's requirements. However, I always do inform and caveat to my clients that be mindful that there will be one or two controllers or one or two organizations that will just refuse your documentation. So it's being mindful that they could refuse it. So that's
I think you're spot on. I mean, likewise with my clients and doing DPIAs. And as you say, one of my clients in particular they supply quite a technical product to schools up and down the country, and there isn't necessarily, as you say, an understanding potentially of how that technology actually operates. So being able to do that proactively is really useful. And you make a good point about the websites. I think the end game for a lot of my clients who are in this position is ultimately to have sort of that web-based trust center where, you know, whether it's a client or even just an average user, a data subject, can go and take a look and see exactly what it is we're doing. And, you know, there's a real transparency to it there. I think that's...
That's my aim too, to have the site as the main point, because honestly, most of the time when I support clients, and same with you, when we're doing DPIAs or risk assessments or part of due diligence, that's the information we know. It's almost a given what sort of information that a controller or the likes of it will seek. So naturally, you know what's going to be asked. So if you can be proactive, it will save them so much burden, because, you know, everyone's busy, you don't want to repeat it, and also there is a risk that the wrong information might be sent out, so therefore it just ensures some consistency across all controllers.
Absolutely. I mean, to be honest, I could yak on about this for you all day, but probably best not to. I think before we start to wrap up, definitely I'm looking at your notes, and there's a particular breach in there that's caught my eye. This WeLeak Info, do you want to talk about this?
Oh, I chuckled on that one for ages. So WeLeak Info is a website that there are paid subscribers. So these are, of course, malicious individuals. They subscribe to search access databases containing about just over 12 billion records of stolen data. So, you know, whenever there's been a hack, whenever there's been a breach, whenever data has been compromised of card details, people's information, well, it's stored with this particular database. And in order to access this database, people can pay for subscription, pay to access them and use it for their own benefits and for their own malicious ways. Anyways, the FBI, along with the, you know, national crimes agencies, amongst Irish agencies, a lot of agencies seized that domain that belonged to WeLeak Information. Now the problem is FBI didn't update an expired domain, which meant that somebody who was very, very sneaky registered that domain to themselves, reset the password, and this individual, he was able to access all, there was a few thousand paid subscribers. So the hackers got hacked and they've had their information hacked into the world. So yeah, that was a bit, it's karma paying its due, I think.
Yeah, those stories really feel good stories in our world. But yeah, interesting that. It's hilarious how I think that how these things can happen. And
I'm still not sure if the FBI, you know, intentionally didn't renew it. I'm not entirely sure about that, but I know that they seized the site. They seized quite a few domains and portals, but I don't know. I'm on the edge on whether they did that intentionally.
The paid subscriber thing is an interesting one, because just quickly, I came across a platform which I think I spoke to you about earlier in the week, which is I mean, nothing to do with this in terms of the actual content that it offers, the service that it offers, but still a paid subscription in the area of privacy. And this is a platform which basically you can pay to subscribe to, and the website will go and search the web as much as it can and return any instances where it thinks that your data is insecure. And it will also allow you to send out bulk deletion requests. So one of my clients got one of these the other day, sort of very boilerplate template, you know, I revoke my consent under article, whichever article it is for consent, Article 7, is it?
Yeah.
I revoke my consent. I, you know, put in an erasure request. I, under the CCPA, I do this. Under state federal laws in America, I do this, et cetera, et cetera. It's not very well tailored. But I just thought it was interesting that those subscriptions are actually popping up. And the cost of it was like $9 a month, which I thought it was pretty extortionate for something which you could do for free given enough time. But it's interesting to see the market go in that direction, I think.
I've come across a few similar tools as well, like Oliver, not PrivacyB, but some other ones as well. Something, I can't remember what it's called, Wired something. And the request for an erasure came in as well. And this my client manages websites. So clients' websites, so that they manage, they host the websites for their clients. So the requests came in, and we were baffled by the source of the information just because of the way that the URL came in. It was a bit of a weird way it came in, but nevertheless, we investigated the back-end processes because nobody could recognize the details on the email. So we searched the hosting, the backups, you name it, searched it, and we couldn't find, they couldn't find this individual. So we notified the client and we said to them, you know, be very cautious when responding to this, because at the end of the day, it doesn't feel like a legitimate request. This feels like a bulk send out to anyone and everyone that might be. And I think that's what worried me. If you're paying for that service, I'm baffled.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I think to be honest, it's preying on people who have previously potentially had their information stolen or fallen victim to a scam. Because clearly, if that's happened to you, I think you're probably going to be more insecure in those environments, and you're going to be more willing to pay for that. And I mean, not to sort of come back to the point too much, but I know we were talking about scams earlier, and the one that I've seen in the news recently is the Royal Mail scam, where you get a text saying that you've not paid postage on something, and off the back of that, you enter a bunch of details to organise a delivery, and then someone posing as the anti-fraud team from your bank calls you up, saying that you've been defrauded, but they're fraudsters themselves. And then they get you to make a bunch of payments. A friend of mine actually unfortunately fell for this recently, and his account's completely emptied. But the sophistication of it's unbelievable, because the number that called him as part of this scam anti-fraud was the actual anti-fraud number of the bank. It was the number on his debit card. And when he put the phone down and called them back, he got through to their actual anti-fraud team. And then when he got a text from his bank confirming what they discussed as part of the cleanup of all of this, it came through on the same number as the fraudulent text had come through on. How on earth are you supposed to differentiate at that stage? You know, it's really, really sophisticated stuff.
I'm baffled by how that is. But then again, you can manipulate what's at the front end, what's really in the back end. You can spoof that sort of stuff, but is scary.
Well, this is what they said to him, and they just sort of said, well, you know, they can copy that, you know. And it's like, could you not try and show some sympathy with someone who's just been defrauded out of a huge amount of money? They didn't seem to care all that much, so he's currently fighting that. But
When I worked in the bank, I used to work in the bank for a couple of big ones actually, and that was so, the amount of fraud in that way is just unreal. Some of them are very sophisticated. Hopefully he's sort of got his money back.
Well, he's working on it at the minute. I'll keep regular listeners up to date on that case.
Please do, because I saw that come in as well, the Royal Mail. I saw it, but I knew I hadn't ordered anything because I've prohibited myself for 3 weeks from buying anything online. So I knew it wasn't me. So I deleted it.
It's bad though, because I got it the other morning. I'd only just woken up, so I was still a bit bleary-eyed. And I was expecting a delivery, and one which previously I'd had to pay postage on myself. So I genuinely almost clicked the link, and I had to think twice. I was like, hang on a second. So it could happen to anybody. So on that fun note, I think we could probably talk about this for hours, but let's not. Miles, next week, what are we talking about? Because I'm not entirely sure, if I'm honest.
I'm just gonna share my screen now with the list of events. So next week we've got data audits. I presume, are you on that one, Dilik?
What's 19th?
26th next week.
Compliance audits.
Yeah.
Of course I'll be on that one.
I was going to say, we need you
for that one. You know, love a bit of audit.
We'll be the same without you on that one, so. Perfect, cool. I'll once this session's done, I'll send a copy out of the recording to everybody, and a link. Everybody should already have a link to the data audit session next week. If you don't, then just drop me a message, and you should be getting the email you get today should have a link to the following session after data audit, so the next GDPR radio. So I'll get that out to everyone today.
Lovely stuff. Brilliant. Right, well, in that case, it only remains for me to thank you, Dilik, for helping me through that. I would thank Phil, but he's already dived off. And thank all of you for joining us.